Hello, and welcome to the second episode of the Historic Present podcast, hosted by myself, Charlie Gordon, and my good friend, Jonah Howe. Jonah.
Hello.
Hello.
In this episode, we delve deep into post-war Germany, and in particular, the Weimar Republic. We look at the constitution itself and the initial struggles and problems it faced during its early years. For our political section, we are joined by a very special guest in a heated political debate. If you would like to listen to this political discussion straight away, skip to the 20-minute mark. Charlie, let's begin. Let's set the scene. We'll go back just a few years from where we finished last week's episode, back to 1918 and the end of the First World War. Kaiser Wilhelm II abdicates and flees to the Netherlands. The once powerful empire is now being sucked in by an empty power vacuum. So, what happens next? As the armistice is signed, Germany is now a free republic state. Something or someone is going to have to take power. In step, the formation of the Weimar Republic. But before we go into the Weimar Republic, I'm just going to paint the picture of what Germany looked like at the end of the First World War. It had been heavily impacted, both economically speaking, politically, and socially. In terms of economic impacts, Germany was left virtually bankrupt at the end of the First World War. The national income was a third of what it had been in 1913, and industrial production was about two-thirds of what it had been during that same year. There were massive shortages of food and consumer goods, as well as a huge cost of war widows' pensions. And politically speaking, as well as the abdication of the Kaiser, there were further political revolutions in Germany from 1918 to 1919, which we will cover shortly. And the Weimar Republic was established, a new democracy. So this Weimar Republic seemed to have an impossible task. They had the job of rebuilding a defeated country. A country, like I said, so crippled by economic sanctions and heavily affected by political and social problems. So, was the collapse of this new democratic Weimar Republic inevitable? Some say yes, due to these three factors. The huge post-war problems imposed on Germany, such as the problems I had just stated. Number two, being forced to sign the Treaty of Versailles, which we covered in depth in last week's episode. And three, a weak core constitution. Now, Charlie, can you explain to us the constitution of the Weimar Republic?
Yes, I can. A constitution is a set of rules on how to govern a state, in which most countries have, such as the modern day we talk about in America, the American Constitution. But this is the Weimar Constitution. The Weimar Constitution was signed in a small town called Weimar, 170 miles southeast of Berlin, because of all the fighting and the street battles and the danger of the capital. So firstly, we have a president, which is elected every 7 years. And this is elected in a presidential election, a separate presidential election. The president will then appoint the chancellor and is appointed from the Reichstag by the president. And the chancellor has to have a majority in the Reichstag, which is often formed by coalition governments, which were considered to be one of the weaknesses, which I will go through shortly. Then we have the Reichstag. So we have proportional representation in it. So it's the German equivalent of parliament, the House of Commons. And we also have the Reichsrat, which is the German equivalent of the House of Lords. So in proportional representation, parties get the same proportion of seats as their proportion of the votes. For example, if the Social Democrats win 20% of the vote, they get 20% of the seats. So very democratic. And also very innovative. And who elects them? Well, the German people election. All adults can vote and have equal rights, all people over the age of 20. So now we're going to talk about the strengths and the weaknesses of the Weimar Constitution. So we'll start with the strengths. The strengths is that all people, all adults, can have the right to vote. The Chancellor also had the backing of a majority. And this system at the time was seen as very innovative and very democratic as well. Then move on to the weaknesses. The weaknesses is that the president, well, actually, no, I should explain Article 48 first. Article 48 was an article in the Constitution in which, in an emergency, the president can make laws without going to the Reichstag, can pass a law by decree. Now, this was considered a weakness because there was no, in the Constitution, there was no definition of what constituted an emergency. So there was always a potential abuse of power. Secondly, proportional representation led to weak coalition governments because of proportional representation, it was hard for any party to get a majority. Furthermore, the proportional representation in the Reichstag meant that it allowed extreme and radical parties to be represented and become familiar in the public eye. So, you know, a good example is in the 1928 election, the Nazis, as we know, the infamous Nazi party who governed Germany from 1933 to 45, they only had 3% of the Reichstag vote, 12 seats. Yet, as a result of this, they were able to have 3% of the Reichstag. Therefore, it allowed extreme radical parties to be represented. And we have to ask ourselves the question, was this weak constitution a cause of the Weimar Republic's eventual failure?
Thank you very much for that, Charlie. I'll just briefly summarise. So what we have is a brand new democratic republic, formed with the low house, the Reichstag, and the high house, the Reichsrat. From the Reichstag, the Chancellor is appointed by the President, who is, in turn, elected every 7 years. So this constitution, like Charlie said, at that time was very forward-looking and very innovative, as it guaranteed civil rights. So this, on the surface, looks like a huge leap in the right direction forward, doesn't it, Charlie?
Yes, definitely.
Yes. And who was the first president of the Weimar Republic? Who was the first person to take charge?
Friedrich Ebert, the leader of the Social Democratic Party.
Friedrich Ebert, the first president of the Weimar Republic. When I was addressing the impact of the war, I briefly mentioned revolution in Germany. There was political unhappiness and unrest over this formation of the Weimar Republic. People didn't want to settle for democracy. So what happens next? The first instance of political uprising and political chaos took place in 1919 through the Spartakists. So who were the Spartakists? The Spartakists were German communists who aimed to build a Soviet Germany in alliance with Soviet Russia. Their leaders were Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. So these communists took to the street of Berlin and thuggishly attempted to fight their way to power. How was this going to be combated?
Well, famously, to combat this threat, the government encouraged the formation of the Freikorps. So these were anti-communist volunteer units, and the Freikorps were essentially people, ex-soldiers who refused to give their weapons back following the First World War.
So very nationalist, aren't they? They're very nationalist.
Yes. Yeah.
And so they'd just come back from fighting for their country.
Yeah. Very, very right-wing. Very, yeah, as you say, nationalistic, patriotic, and very anti-communist. And Ebert effectively used them and let them loose on the communists. And the poorly organized Spartakists were eventually crushed during bloody street battles.
Very
in Berlin.
Easily as well.
Yeah, and then on the 15th of January, the Freikorps soldiers end up murdering the two leaders, Luxembourg and Liebknecht. And that was over before it even began.
Yeah, so quite a swift turnaround of this attempted coup. It goes down as nothing more than a failed uprising loss in no more than five days.
It leads the path for Germany, and it shows Ebert, you know, the leader of this new republic, that there is unrest, civil unrest and unhappiness, that people aren't accepting the change. So one question we have to ask ourselves is, would the German people accept an almost instant change from the traditional autocratic German system of government to this new democratic system? The answer is
no. And that's exactly what history and the evidence suggests. But the political unrest and uprisings did not stop there. In 1920, similar events repeated. On the 13th of March 1920, right-wing extremists, so the complete opposite end of the political spectrum, right-wing extremists stage an armed rising in Berlin. Freikorps units, as Charlie just explained who they were, led by General von Ludwitz, seized control of the capital and named Wolfgang Kapp as Germany's new leader. And for his namesake, this uprising goes by the name of the Kapp Putsch, Putsch meaning rising in German. The German army refused to fire on the Freikorps, as of course the Freikorps was made up mostly of ex-soldiers themselves. But how did the rising fail? Well, essentially, as Ebert used the right wing to deal with the left-wing uprisers, he's gone and flipped it from Kapp Putsch.
Vice versa.
Exactly. So he uses his support with the unions and the more left-wing working class to stage a massive general strike in protest at the uprising. This was catastrophic. It paralyzed the city. Millions of workers across Germany joined in on the strike. And on the 18th of March, Kapp and Ludwitz were forced to throw in the towel. And I think they actually fled to Sweden, if I'm right.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
So what we've got here is in 1919, Ebert uses the right to crush the left. And then in 1920, he uses the left to crush the right. And this creates an increasingly splitting divide between the German peoples. You're getting a massive polarization of political beliefs between fellow civilians of the same country. It's brewing the perfect ingredients for a civil war.
It's also important to understand that these weren't the only revolutions in Germany between the years of 1919 to 1922. There were others less significant. So we had the Red Army of the Ruhr in 1920 in protest of the Kapp Putsch, the right-wing murder squads in 1921 to 22, and we have revolution in Bavaria. So these are mainly regional revolutions, and it's effectively a political free-for-all at this point.
Yeah, precisely.
There seems to be no stability within the government to stop anything happening. And this is the most critical part for the Weimar Republic. Can they push through? Can they get out of this period of what we call, as historians, chaos, and move in to the golden years?
Yes, precisely. There is mounting pressure on the newly formed Democratic Weimar Republic. How can they overcome all these political uprisings and unrest and prosper and bring equality and innovative legal systems to Germany? Well, fortunately, the Weimar Republic does survive these political scares, and they move out of a period of chaos that lasted for 4 years, from 1918 to 1923, to a prosperous, luxurious period that we will name the Golden Years. But the Weimar Republic is dealt one final blow before they can move into calmer and more peaceful years. So, Charlie, Tell me a little bit about the French occupation of the Ruhr and how it might have affected Weimar Germany.
Well, this French occupation and Belgian occupation of the Ruhr was an economic disaster. So the Treaty of Versailles destabilized Germany politically, but Germans also blamed it for another problem, economic chaos. So moving back to the treaties, we're looking at reparations here. So the reparations bill was announced in April 1921. It was set at 6.6 billion to be paid in annual installments over the years. The Germans protested that this was an intolerable strain on their economy, which they were struggling to rebuild after the war. But their protests were, quite frankly, ignored by the Allies. So moving to the occupation of the Ruhr. So the first installment of 50 million was paid in 1921. But in 1922, they paid nothing. Eber did his best to play for time and negotiate concessions from the Allies. But the French, in particular, ran out of patience, as we see earlier on. Yeah. The French lack patience. They too had to pay war debts to the USA. So in January 1923, French and Belgian troops entered the Ruhr, quite legally under the Treaty of Versailles, and began to take what was owed to them in the form of raw materials and goods. So the Ruhr was the economic heartland of Germany, the industrial heartland.
100%.
A lot of its economy, I think a fifth of its economy came from the Ruhr. So the results of the occupation of the Ruhr were really disastrous for Germany. The government ordered the workers to go on strike, and that way there'd be nothing for the French to take away. And the French reacted harshly, and they killed over 100 workers and expelled 100,000 protesters from the region. And more importantly, the halt in industrial production in Germany's most important region caused the collapse of the German currency, which leads us on to hyperinflation. Because it had no goods to trade, the government simply printed money. I mean,
oh dear.
It sounds like a great idea. I mean, what an idea.
This is not how economics works.
And this,
works,
for the government, seemed attractive. It paid off its debts in worthless marks, including war loans over 2.2 billion. The great industrialists were able to pay off their debts as well. And this set off a chain reaction. With so much money in circulation, but not enough goods to buy with it, prices and wages skyrocketed. People soon realized that this money was worthless. Workers literally needed wheelbarrows to carry home their wages. Wages began to be paid daily instead of weekly. The price of goods could rise between the joining of the back of the queue in a shop and reaching the front. Jonah, I mean, what do you think?
Just further absolute chaos. People's life savings have become absolutely worthless overnight. If you've spent your entire life saving up, I don't know, let's say a million German marks, overnight that a million marks couldn't even buy you a loaf of bread. Do you know what the price of a loaf of bread was?
Well, I've got an actual timeline in front of me, Jonah.
Oh, let's
in 1980, in this is great. I mean, the price of a loaf of bread in 1918 was 0.63 marks, so 60. I don't know what
a reasonable price.
1922, 163 marks.
Oh wow!
January 1923. 250 marks, steady. July 1923, 3,465
marks. In a matter of months.
September 1923, 2 months later, 1,500,000 marks. And November 1923, I don't even know what this number is. I mean, it's got a lot of zeros. Yeah, you all know.
Go
I'm
on,
not very good at maths.
Just try.
I believe it says, is it 201 billion marks, I believe. Billion. You heard me right.
Okay, well, I'm going to trust that's what the number actually is. But 201
billion
for
I think
a loaf of bread.
I mean, it's just insane.
The scenes. It is hurrying a wheelbarrow full of notes, of worthless pieces of paper.
No.
As like you said, prices...
Well, this was clearly one of the worst decisions the government, the Republic had ever made.
But were they forced to do it because of the Allies?
They were. Yeah, well, you know, it seemed like a good solution, but it turned out to be one of the worst mistakes they ever made because, you know, I think now we understand, you know, we have hindsight, as I always like
to mention. Yeah, I know, but what I'm asking is,
yeah.
Did they have no choice but to do this?
Because
the huge reparations imposed on them led to them not being able to pay one installment.
I agree with you, Jonah. I don't think they had a lot of choice. I think it was more they didn't know what to do, and that seemed the only feasible solution.
It is as evident as it is now, as it was back in the 1920s. Both inside and outside of Germany, that the situation needed urgent action. And so, in August 1923, a new government under Gustav Stresemann took over. So what did Gustav Stresemann first do? Number one, he called off the passive resistance in the Ruhr. He called in the worthless marks and burned them, replacing them with a new currency called the Rentenmark. This immediately stopped the utter chaos of hyperinflation. He negotiated to receive American loans under the Dawes Plan. This automatically eased the economic pressure mounting on Germany. And the Weimar Republic can take one huge deep breath, a huge sigh of relief, and hopefully move on from this period of chaos.
That concludes the second episode of the Historic Present podcast, hosted by myself, Charlie Gordon, and Jonah Howe. First of all, we want to thank Xavi for coming on and providing us with a fiery political debate, which was very interesting and very enjoyable to argue with him. Second of all, we want to thank you all for your support of the last episode, which received 280 listens overall. And... you know, me and Jonah are very grateful for that. And we put a lot of time into making this. So thank you for the support. Also, we want you to comment the winner on our latest Instagram post at the Historic Present Podcast on Instagram. We also want to let you know that we're doing this on Zoom. So we're recording this on Jonah's end. So my audio may sound a bit, as Oliver Dyson would say, like a football commentator. And that's goodbye from me, and goodbye from Jonah.
Goodbye.